Welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I am your host, Bart Vanderzee, and I am extremely excited today to be joined by John Sheridan. He is the man who is the expert on Gretsch. John, how are you?
Hey, Bart, man, I'm doing well.
Awesome. Well, this is going to be really cool because Gretsch is one of those companies that has just always been at the forefront of drum technology and pushing things forward. And, I mean, they are a classic brand that I know very little about, and I'm excited to learn more about it. I mean, all I know is they are 136 years old. That is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. And they still have their own teeth.
Yeah, exactly. They got a lot of teeth. Yeah. So I think we should just go ahead and start with the beginning of the history, because we got a long history here for this company. So why don't you just take it away and start at the beginning?
Okay. Well, the company was founded by Frederick Gretsch, and he was born in 1856 in Mannheim, Germany. He came to America at the age of 16, which would be 1872. And Frederick opened his own shop in 1883 on Middleton Street in Brooklyn, which is the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn, which is the part of Brooklyn. I mean, it's right on the East River, and it faces the Lower East Side. But he opened his own shop in 1883, and the focus at that time was building drums, banjos, and tambourines, basically anything with a head. Because what, you know, he would do is that he would buy the skins from local slaughterhouses, and and he would tan them on the roof, you know, of the building. And, you know, he was very hands-on. I mean, he had people that working for him. He did have a small crew, you know, but, you know, within a decade or so, I mean, you know, he was definitely making inroads in growing the business. But unfortunately, on April 28th of 1895, he died of cholera.
Oh my God!
At the age of 39, during a trip to his native Germany, which is, you know, unfortunate for the family. But his eldest son, Friedrich Sr., who was only 15 at the time and still in knickers, he basically took over the company, and with the help of his mother, Rosa, you know, helped keep things afloat. You know, they just kept it going. By 1916, they had to expand the business into a 10-story building that's 60 Broadway in Brooklyn that they had built. Because by the turn of the century, they were the largest music wholesaler in the country. I mean, they were just killing it, because they were also doing a lot of importing and exporting. But there were a lot of brands from overseas. So they were kind of like a jobber, you know. Also, yeah, at that time, they were just kind of like just a big distributor, and so they were able to service a lot of dealers, I guess, back then, you know, or small music shops. I mean, you know, back then, I mean, it was like, it's horse and buggy deliveries, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
really, Amazon didn't exist at that point.
Yeah, right. I mean, and cars were not really in wide use as of yet either. So
yeah,
it was
really,
you know. So you just kind of imagine. I mean, these are the old days. So
yeah. Well, okay. So 1916. Just to clarify, we're in Brooklyn. We just moved to the 10-story building.
Right.
At 60 Broadway. Are we primarily, I know you said we're distributing from importing goods. Are we doing mainly drums now and tambourines still, or have they expanded into? Okay,
yeah.
So it's prime. So Gretsch is drums from the beginning.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And but they, like I said, they were carrying like a lot of other instruments, from other like smaller companies and distributing them. I mean, like even photograph needles and things like that, you know, like just like all kinds of things, you know. So,
wow. Who was their competition at that point?
Well, I mean, as far as, Ludwig was still in their infancy. I mean, they started in 1909 and their big thing was the drum pedal, but I know that they quickly advanced into other things, you know. But I'm not the Ludwig expert.
Sure, no,
You know, and I believe Slingerland came later. Well, I know that Rogers started in 1849, but but I think primarily they were making drum heads, you know.
Yeah.
Pretty much the same way Gretsch was making drum heads. But I do believe that later on, I think maybe by the 30s. I mean, I'm not absolutely sure about this, but I've heard they were supplying drum shells to, that Gretsch was supplying drum shells to Rogers.
Interesting. Okay.
So, yeah, so that's, I mean, I can't prove that.
Sure,
know, it's
yeah.
It's something that I've heard, so.
Well, that's cool.
You know, food for thought, whatever. So.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to just kind of put it in perspective to see what's going on. And, I mean, no one was ever alone in this, in the endeavor to be the biggest, you know, drum companies out there, but
right. So yeah. But I mean, like, and at this point, like the drum set, I mean, was, you know, like in its infancy too. I mean, it's like that kind of happened a bit later, you know. But I mean, you know, drums were being made, of course. I mean, at least bass drums, the snare drums, of course. You know?
Yeah.
Like in 1918, Fred Gretsch Sr., he develops, you know, the revolutionary multiply drum lamination process, which resulted in the creation of the world's first warp-free drum hoop.
Wow. Okay.
And then by 1927, they introduced the industry's first multiply drum shell. So that was kind of a big deal because traditionally, you know, drum shells were, you know, they take a solid piece of wood, steam bed it into a circle, and then glue reinforcement rings inside the top and bottom so it would maintain its shape. You know, but
yeah.
But they actually came up with staggered plies in 1927, which is pretty much the way just about every drum company, you know, makes drum shells now.
Yeah, and that's, so they guaranteed, I remember seeing some catalogs where they guarantee that the drum will not warp. And I guess at that point in time, for you to guarantee something to not happen means that that's happening a lot to a lot of drummers. So that's like, hey, if I buy this and I invest in this drum, it's not going to go warping on me and the heads won't fit. So that had to be a huge deal when that came about.
Yeah. And the thing is that sometimes when, you know, drums are like drum shells are rolled, you know, in the traditional sense, very often there's a flat spot and it's not totally round. And so that can cause problems. And it's also been a belief, by some people that, having reinforcement rings inside the shell, that it can actually distort the tone of the shell. And then also, it also naturally raises the pitch, you know, the fundamental pitch of the shell.
They know all this, and it seems like they were kind of ahead of their time with the actual technology involved in creating what was, you know, what would become kind of the standardized drum.
Oh yeah, because they were building their own shells. I mean, they had their own chucks and everything, and you know, there's old factory pictures where you see them, you know, doing that back then. And, they were pretty self-sufficient. I mean, you know, they would source some stuff, you know, from other manufacturers, not drum manufacturers, but just like, you know, metal companies and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that for the round badges, I know that they had at least two different sources that they were getting those from, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. So we should note that on the Gretsch website, it says in 1920, they are recognized as...
Oh, the largest musical instrument manufacturer in the U.S.
Yes. So they got to be doing something right. And to have to be churning out that many instruments, you're going to need a little help getting like the metal parts and all that. But that's pretty huge to be... From 1883 to 1920, to become the U.S.'s largest manufacturer is pretty huge.
Yeah. That's not even 40 years.
No, exactly. Cool. So we're at 1920. Then let's keep moving forward here. So I'm seeing that 1927, which is obviously a huge year, kind of jumping around here for that's the switch of trap drummers in the silent movie stuff to get into talking movies. So that changes kind of the dynamic just across the whole industry.
Absolutely, that very much changes things, you know. And in the 30s, that's when you know, by then. Well, also keep in mind that Gretsch was also making banjos and stuff like that, because banjos were really hot, especially in the 20s.
Yeah.
But in the 30s, you know, I mean, by the time 1930 hits, I mean, you know, you got the Depression, and, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. Yeah, there's talkies, but, you know, but you also needed that nickel to get in the theater, you know.
Exactly.
And not everybody had that, you know, so they had the... use their nickels to buy frivolous things like food.
Yeah, exactly, to stay alive. So with the banjo then, they're obviously competing with Slingerland, who was kind of famous for making banjos at first. So
you're never
alone just making a product.
Oh, yeah,
you always have competition.
Oh, yeah. Well, and banjos were just like incredibly hot during the 20s. I mean, you know, it was like the 20s was just like, that was, you know, they called the Roaring Twenties for a good reason, you know, because they really did roar, and, you know, it was before Prohibition and all that. I mean, it was wild, you know, and flappers and the whole thing, and, you know, then the Depression hit, and that was kind of all over. But by the early 30s, that's also when Gretsch started building guitars. And they were acoustic models at first, and then they didn't start getting into electrics until, you know, a bit later, you know, certainly by, like, I guess, you know, late 40s or so. You know, the drums were, you know, were always the mainstay of the company. And all that, you know, just continued to progress.
Yeah, I didn't, going into this, I didn't know, because I say it from time to time that, like, going into these episodes, I am not an expert on Gretsch. I don't know much about it until we actually talk, and then I learn, and everyone's kind of learning together. But I didn't know if drums were first. I didn't know if guitar was first. So it's really cool.
No. Drums were,
I love that.
Like, practically from the first day. I mean, you know, there's always been drums, I mean, going way back.
Yeah, exactly. So 1935, Gretsch introduces the Broadcaster series of drums. Mm-hmm. Now, is this, this would be considered kind of their flagship famous drum line?
Yeah. It, I mean, it's Broadcaster, and I guess they they spelt it with a K just to be different.
Yep.
So, you know, you got to call it something. So I guess, and, you know, broadcasting, you know, I mean, radio was really big at the day, and radio broadcasts, I guess that's where that came from. So, yeah, the Broadcaster line. And throughout the decades, Gretsch did reintroduce that name a number of times. And even today, as of, I think, about 2015 or 14. Actually, it was late 2014, going into 15, they came out with a new Broadcaster line, which is a 3-ply drum shell versus the 6-ply that they started making in the very late 50s. But, you know, we can get into that. You know,
sure.
The road.
And not super important, but at this point, logo wise, we have the older Gretsch logo that has the extended T going over the curved Gretsch, correct? Just to kind of throw in all the information.
Yeah. You mean the badge?
The badge. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because on other instruments in literature, there's a straight version of that. They weren't using that on the guitars yet, but the but on other literature, they would refer to that as the T roof logo.
Gotcha.
The top portion of the T would act as like a roof over most of the other letters. And it was just a very stylized way of making the Gretsch name prominent and definitely cool. So
yeah.
But they rounded it off when they started making the badge, and that's also around the time that the Gretsch badge, the round badge that we all know and love, the 30s is really like when that badge first came into being. Because before that, they did have other badges, but they were kind of like, you know, more, I don't know, I guess more nondescript. They were either like plates or, in some cases, it was just a simple little decal, you know. And when it comes to Gretsch badges, I mean, that's certainly like a whole other thing in terms of, like in the book that the Gretsch drum book that Rob Cook and I put together. We have like the whole chronology of badges, and the fact I'm looking at it right now and in some cases, they were just like decals.
That's funny. Early on,
they were just mounted on. But the, they did have there was this kind of unusual, square badge that said Gretsch American USA and so forth. But the round badge that we all know, it was certainly in use by the 30s.
We're entering a pretty tricky time in America. The Great Depression, we are approaching, if not in World War II at this point. And I know that Gretsch is also coming up on an ownership change, which I want to just say up front to people, if you keep hearing Fred Gretsch over a 100-year span, you're not going crazy. There are multiple Fred Gretsches.
It's pretty easy to keep straight, actually. I mean, like when I first... Before I knew, I was very confused too.
Yeah, exactly.
Because Because the first thing I'm thinking, well, how old is this guy?
Exactly. That's
can't
what I thought.
Can't be the same Fred Gretsch. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, can't be, you know?
No.
So, I mean, there was the original Friedrich Gretsch, yep, who came from Germany, and he's the guy that started, you know, the Gretsch company in 1883. And then there's his son, Fred Gretsch Sr.
Yep.
And he's the gentleman that took over his dad's company after his dad passed away.
And he's running it up until this point that we're talking about, which is kind of where we then switch to another Fred.
Yeah. Then there's his son, Fred Gretsch Jr. And Fred, Fred Gretsch Jr., he comes in 1942, to become company president. But of course, once the attack on Pearl Harbor happens, and that drives the U.S. into World War II. And of course, I mean, people were very patriotic back then, and
yep,
you got to defend your country and what you believe in. So he joined the Navy, and I believe he quickly rose to the rank of commander. So he went off to war, and then Fred Jr.'s brother, Bill, or William Gretsch, he takes over the company while Fred Jr. is at war, and Bill Gretsch is the father of today's Fred Gretsch, Fred W. Gretsch.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Fred, and unfortunately, Bill Gretsch, Fred W. Gretsch's father, he died in 1948, and I think Fred W. was only like two when his dad died.
Gotcha.
You know, which is sad, you know, but...
So then during World War II, like most of these companies, which I actually talked to Joe Meckler all about in episode two, is the World War II era drums, which Gretsch was obviously involved in with the metal rationing.
Sure.
So they did all that, which if you want to hear more about that stuff, then I recommend checking out episode two.
I can give you a little anecdote that you
please
see anywhere else.
Yeah, love it.
The Bill Hagner, who was he worked for Gretsch in Brooklyn starting in 1941 as a foreman. He's still alive.
Wow.
He lives in Florida, and I think he's in his 90s now. He told a story about during the war that they actually, just to keep the shop going, that one of the things that they did was they built waste paper baskets.
Really?
Like out of, like they take like a 9x13 drum shell.
Oh my God.
Put a bottom on it and... You know?
That's amazing.
But actually, I just remembered there is something else that they did during the war. They did manufacture stuff for the war effort. They also built gas masks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, like, you know, those long elephant trunk looking things?
Yeah, real scary looking now that...
Yeah, right. Yeah. And the thing is like those hoses are kind of like reinforced, and because, you know, Gretsch could build, you know, drum hoops. Like they would, like those hoses were like reinforced with like these little drum hoops.
Wow,
you know,
that's amazing.
Build because they had, and they were made out, you know, and so like anything made out of wood, you know, because they could only use 10% by content metal, you know, so they could use very little metal in anything that they made, unless it was for the war effort, because that's why they were conserving metal, so they could build bombs and tanks and stuff like that. So. But I know that one of the things that they built for the war effort were gas masks.
That's wild. I know, I think Joe was saying that Rogers was making like the instruments that would be in like planes, like the gauges and all that stuff. So that's really cool drum history to kind of hear about what they were doing. The waste baskets thing is just crazy. Now, is that wasn't like we're making waste baskets for the war effort. That was just, we need to keep the lights on and sell something.
Exactly. It was just something that they could make to kind of keep the lights on. Wow. I mean, I'm sure there were other like things, novelties, or what's not necessarily a novelty, a novel idea for a drum company, but it's you know, but every office needs a waste paper basket.
Hey,
you know,
people got garbage. Yeah,
exactly.
That's amazing. Yeah. Cool. Mm-hmm. All right, so we go through World War II. What was the? I completely forget. What is the? They had though a war outfit of drums, right? Like, what was their? I know there's the Rolling Bomber. What was Gretsch? What was theirs called?
Oh, that's right. The Defender.
The Defender. Cool.
Yep.
They had some cool names.
1942, 1946, World War II era drums with wooden lugs, because the War Production Board had ruled that no more than 10% of the weight of war era drums could be made of critical materials, i.e. metal.
So then we get through World War II. I see something noted here that says in 1946 they produced the first production double bass drum
for Louis Belson.
For Louis Belson, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yep.
That's
The story was that Louis went to all the drum manufacturers, you know, one by one, as he was being turned down. I mean, the drum set, as we know it, and as it was known back then, when you think about it, it's still a pretty modern contraption, or fairly new, rather. I mean, it was something that, I mean, wasn't around that long back then, you know, maybe a couple of decades. So so when he came up with this idea and these plans to build this double bass kit, I mean, all the other companies looked at him like he had two heads and, you know, just said, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, no one's going to buy that. Yeah.
Yeah, right. You know, so... So then when he brought it to Gretsch, they said, well, why not?
Yeah.
You can do that. The thing is, if you've ever seen, I mean, they built him a number of double bass drum kits throughout the 40s and 50s. But if you look at the very first one that they built for him, I mean, not only is it a double bass drum kit, they're what would be known in the 1980s as power depth,
yeah.
You know, I mean,
they're huge.
You know, they're not just big around. I mean, you know, they're very deep, you know,
yeah.
And they're the first company to do that, you know, and then he had this huge, what looks like a cocktail drum, like this very long, tall floor tom,
yeah.
Between all the other toms.
That's wild.
You know, yeah. And the other toms were also kind of unusual sizes.
Yeah. And they go in a weird order. They go kind of like, they mm-hmm. sort of start small on the left and then go a little bigger, and then you got your mega floor tom, and then they kind of go back down in size. So he's obviously a very revolutionary guy.
And
he's interesting with getting his start in the Gene Krupa drum competition and all that mm-hmm. really cool stuff. But that's, again, another...
And he was like an absolute gentleman. I met him once at Joe Casadas' Modern Drum Shop in New York.
Hmm.
I used to go there fairly often, and I was there one day talking to Joe Casadas, and Louis Belson walks in with his manager, and he had just purchased a cymbal, and he just wanted the cluster of rivets installed.
Yeah.
And so there's nobody else in the store, so they go off and start drilling the cymbal and put the rivets in, and there's nobody there except for him and me, you know. So I introduced myself and say how much I've always admired him, and I can't tell you like how nice he was. I mean, but not just how nice he was, but like from head to toe, he was perfect.
Really?
I mean, his hair was like perfectly coiffed, and like his skin, the clothes he was wearing. He was wearing this beautiful suit with what do you call it? A camel, you know, that kind of light brown, you know, top coat, you know, and he was just like his shoes, you know, like shined perfectly. I mean, he was meticulous. I mean, and he was so pleasant, and he was so, without sounding pretentious or pompous or any, none of that. I mean, but he was just a perfect gentleman. I mean, like, just an amazing guy, but he was the first guy with a double kick, and Gretsch was the only company that would build it for him.
Wow, so. What a cool story! Because you know, you never want to hear that a drummer's a jerk, and I don't think I need to say the name of who I'm thinking of, who is an amazing drummer but gets a little bit of a bad reputation.
I realize that. I mean, I'm always reminded of the John Lennon quote, which is, meeting your heroes is usually pretty disappointing.
You know? Yeah.
not have anything to do with Gretsch, but just as an aside, I've known Hal Blaine.
Yeah.
Since
wow.
I mean, I've known him for over 30 years, and he's another guy that is just like the nicest guy
wow.
in the world.
He just had a birthday.
And, yeah, he just turned 90 on February 5th, and I was invited to go, but I just couldn't get away.
Man,
at the Baked Potato in North Hollywood. You know, I hope it
yeah.
went well.
Every little person you meet, that spreads like a kind of a ripple, and they tell two people, and they tell two people, and so that's good to hear.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure, exactly.
So we are approaching what would be considered the golden era of Gretsch,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure there's multiple, but kind of yeah. before we get there, I know in 48, Bill passes away.
Right. Okay. Fred W.'s dad.
Yeah. Fred W.'s dad. So then Fred Gretsch Jr., Bill's brother, Fred Gretsch Jr. Mm-hmm. went off to war, gave Bill the company. He mm-hmm. resumes, he goes back to being in charge, correct?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. So then, so he's in charge when we're entering the 1950s here. Now, am I mm-hmm. skipping anything or am I...
No, well, by 1950, 1949, 1950, that's when Gretsch Hardware starts to change. Like now we're getting into the Streamliner lugs,
okay.
you know, versus the rocket lugs that Gretsch was using up to that point. Phil Grant, who I think is a guy that we haven't mentioned yet, Phil was... what Jimmy Webster was to Gretsch guitars, that's what Phil Grant was to Gretsch drums. You know, he was the drum guy. You know, he was the guy that that was very much involved with you know, the endorsers and the products and stuff like that. So that was kind of like really his thing, and he was the guy that because if you've ever seen any of those old Gretsch drums with the rocket lugs, you know, they're nickel plated and, you know, they're, you know, I mean, I know that there are some guys out there who'll say, oh yeah, well, those are awesome looking, you know, but he felt that the hardware should look nicer, that it should be chrome plated. In his words, that the drums should have more dignity, you know.
It's a good way to put it. It's a very classy era.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like, you know, just like, you know, and that's when, you know, Gretsch drums really start to look like the Gretsch drums that we know and love, you know.
So that kind of transitions into the era where people are, I feel like the playing style even changes. People are getting a little, mm-hmm. not heavier. I mean, you're playing more. Things are being amplified where you need to be a little bit louder then, and you're playing a little bit harder, and the gear needs to be able to handle that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, sure, sure. Oh, also, I should mention also around this time is Gretsch was the first company to make the 20-inch bass drum.
Really?
You know?
Cool.
Yeah, Davy Tuff, he was the guy that that wanted a smaller bass drum because, you know, if you've ever played drums in a city like New York or Chicago or wherever, and you're dealing with cabs and stairs and stuff like that, and back then, you know, bass drums were enormous. They were 24, 26 inches, whatever, in diameter. And it's like, you know, they wouldn't fit in the trunk of a cab, you know, like even back then when cabs were like trucks, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's like drums were just so ridiculously enormous. Drums don't have to be big to sound big.
No, exactly. You know? Yeah.
Because like, you know, even an 18-inch bass drum or in Davy Tuff's case, a 20-inch bass drum. I mean, the 18 came later. But the 20-inch bass drum, I mean, that was revolutionary, you know. But, I mean, a 20-inch bass drum is still a good size. I mean,
oh,
that's,
yeah.
you know, like, you should be able to do the job with a 20,
yeah.
you know.
It's super common today. I mean, a lot of people use 20s.
But back then, it was like, you know, nobody played a bass drum that small, you know.
Yeah.
But that was kind of like the beginning of, like, Gretsch being known for, like putting together the smaller drum kits, you
yeah.
know, so...
The bebop kind of sizes.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know, and then it wasn't too long afterwards that instead of 9x13s, 8x12s, instead of 16x16 floor toms, 14x14s. And then by the early 50s, you know, Max Roach, yep. you know, had his own signature snare drum with Gretsch, which was a 4x14. And, you know, which is basically a piccolo snare drum, yeah. you know. And there were, like, a few others. I mean, I know that WFL made a Buddy Rich 3x13 snare, which is pretty cool. It looks like a yeah. flying saucer, you know.
Very but, progressive, though, for that era, obviously.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. In fact, a few years when they stopped calling it the Max Roach signature snare drum, they started calling it the progressive jazz snare drum.
Well, there you go.
you know, so there you go, like from your mouth to
yeah.
to the Gretsch catalog.
Exactly. So. that's the way it goes. Yeah. Jumping around a little bit, what is the involvement of the Fred Gretsch Company with Zildjian? Because I did a whole history on Zildjian that I didn't release, and I haven't done anything with it yet. But there is, I can't remember if it's A or K or what they owned the rights to in America.
It was K. Let me just because I know that it was in 1926.
Okay.
Yeah, in the summer of 1926, the company acquired all rights to the K. Zildjian Cymbal Company. Now, if you know anything about Zildjian, you know that they didn't move from Turkey to America until 1929.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, so, and then that's a whole thing, and then they would release them as A, and then, yeah, that's a whole fascinating thing. And there's actually court documents that you can find of them suing each other, trying to get or Zildjian suing Gretsch, trying to get the rights back for years.
Yeah. Oh yeah, sure. You know, in the book that that Rob and I wrote, I mean, there is a section that's covered, you know, about the whole, because it to a lot of people it is very, very, very confusing.
It was extremely confusing. So. Just getting that in people's minds that Gretsch controlled the American distribution rights for Zildjian
yeah.
back, mm-hmm. way back. So, okay, well, we can spend hours on this. So let's try and push forward here. All right, so yeah. we're in the 50s. So we got Max Roach in 1950. I'm clicking along here. We got Max Roach 50. Art Blakey comes on in 1954. So they're in the public eye as being this kind of progressive jazz drumming kind of world, which is obviously a very rock and roll wasn't exactly sweeping the nation quite yet.
No.
60s, we're going through the 60s. Tony Williams comes on, obviously, with his very famous yellow Gretsch drum set that everyone knows. the relationship with Birdland Studios is happening in...
I think the yellow Tony Williams kid, I think that came later. Oh, but as a kid, he started playing Gretsch drums like in 1959 when he was like 15 years old.
Really? You know? Okay.
So, yeah. So I don't know if he was an official endorser then, but I know that he started playing them. I actually have some original Gretsch drum head boxes with the drum head still in them from the 60s. That mentions Tony Williams as an endorser.
Cool.
Only back then he was called Anthony Williams.
Wow.
You know,
that's funny.
It's just funny to see that. You know.
Yeah. So, yeah. All right. So then, 1967, we enter. You mentioned it before. Fred Gretsch Jr. retires, and he sells to Baldwin, which is the first major sale of the company.
Yeah. Well, at that time, in the 60s. Well, the thing is that let's not forget the Beatles. The Beatles absolutely revolutionized the MI business. You can't possibly underestimate when you spoke to Bill Ludwig III
yep.
about Ludwig. The phones were ringing off the hook the next day after they appeared on Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
Well, with Gretsch, George Harrison played a Gretsch Country Gentleman guitar, and it was the same thing.
That's amazing.
Because the thing is that these companies, you know, when they order supplies like lumber and stuff that they need to build their instruments, they base their orders on the previous year. Like, let's say in the case of a drum company, well, last year we ordered like these many rims and these many lugs and so forth and so on. And, you know, with guitar parts, it's the same thing. You order this much lumber and tuning pegs and pickups and so forth, and you forecast what you think you're going to do in the following year.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Beatles happen, And nobody sees this coming, you know. And it's and all of a sudden, everything just goes topsy. And you know, so for Gretsch, I mean, you know, they had Country Gentlemen's in stock, but after the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan, they were very soon out of stock. And then the Country Gentlemen's, I mean, I heard that, you know, they were back ordered for 2 years, but that kind of sounds like an exaggeration. But
yeah,
but one thing that I know that isn't is Dan Duffy is a guy that I know that worked for Gretsch back in the day. And he was on the guitar side. And he said that before the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan in 1964, prior to that, we were building 17, maybe 20 guitars a day. But after that, we were building 75 to 100 guitars a day.
Wow.
So
yeah,
if you think of, so you figure what was going on with the guitars, I mean, it was probably this, the drum manufacturing was probably augmented in the same way.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing is that not everybody was like kind of, you know, brand oriented.
Yeah.
I think that there were a lot of people that just wanted a drum set.
Yeah, I want to be a drummer.
Or an electric guitar.
Yeah.
Or something that they could afford, you know?
Yeah.
So, and because like the interview you did with the MIJ drums,
mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, Made in Japan.
Yep.
I mean, that stuff just took off because
exactly.
You could buy a Japanese-made drum set for, you know, a fraction of what you'd pay for a U.S.-made kit, you know? So...
So... Then that explosion happens. It's then interesting to me that why did Gretsch sell to Baldwin in 67? What was the catalyst for
that? What was going on? The other trend that was happening was that all these big corporations were taking notice of these little mom and pop musical instrument companies like Leo Fender and Fred Gretsch and Joseph Rogers, and they were saying like, well, there's a lot of money in now there is in musical instruments. So we had all these big corporations buying these companies. I mean, in 1965, CBS bought Fender. They bought Fender for $15 million.
Hmm.
Now, 2 years earlier, CBS bought the New York Yankees for $13
million. Oh, wow. That kind of puts it in perspective.
Yeah. I mean, that shows you, like, what kind of money there was to be made at the time.
Yeah.
You know, when this was going on.
So, Baldwin, 67 to 85, kind of jumping ahead here for time's sake, did quality dip? Or did it remain pretty consistent?
Well, after Baldwin bought Gretsch for... $4 million. What happened was they decided to move manufacturing from Brooklyn to Boonville, Arkansas, because Baldwin owned a banjo factory in Boonville, Arkansas. It was really like a converted barn.
Wow.
And so they moved everything by rail in the summer of 69. And the reason why they moved it in the summer is because, you know, a lot of people go on vacation, you know, retail slow, you know, people go away, not many people are buying musical instruments that time of year, so they figured, well, that's a good time to make the move. So so they moved everything, and they got Bill Hagner to set up the factory in Boonville, and hire people off the small towns and farms and the immediate area and teach them craftsmanship and all that. But, you know, it takes a while to get good at building that stuff. And,
oh, yeah.
There was certainly a dip in the... I don't hear too many people complaining about the drums from that era. I hear mostly about the guitars, you know, from that era. Now, not to say that everything was bad back then, you know, but...
Yeah, but it changed a little bit.
It did, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, what happens when one company buys another, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we got to pay off this note, so how can we make it cheaper and charge more money for it?
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So, you know, to help pay off the note. So, although actually in the case of Gretsch, it's probably not true because I was told by Fred Gretsch that Baldwin paid cash.
Oh boy.
For Gretsch, you know, so they, yeah. So I guess they didn't have a note to pay, but that doesn't mean that other companies, like, you know, when Norlin bought Gibson or Avnet bought Guild, or, you know, but that was a trend that was definitely going on in the 60s. These corporations were buying up these small music companies, these family-owned music companies.
Now, very similar to the Ludwig story, there is a triumphant return of the Gretsch family to the ownership. So Fred W. Gretsch, son of Bill, who is the son of the original of Fred Sr., correct? He gets the company back in the family in 1985.
Yeah, he. Let me just preface it with a little story. In 1967, when Fred W. Gretsch was 21 years old, his uncle, Fred Gretsch Jr., took him out to Peter Luger's, which is a steakhouse right down the street, which has been there since 1887. The Gretsch family still has a table there.
Every
year for my birthday, I go there and sit at the Gretsch table.
Nice. That's awesome.
So anyway, but the thing is that but he took young Fred out to lunch and said, I've sold the company, you know, to Baldwin. And young Fred says, but I wanted to own it.
Of course.
And he said, yeah, well, Baldwin paid cash for it. And says, we're going to be working for Baldwin from now on. But Fred W. swore that day that he would one day be able to get the company back, you know, into family ownership.
Which he did.
It took him 17 years, but he did it. Because every time he approached Baldwin, the answer was always no. But the ironic thing is what happened. Baldwin, by that time, had gotten into investments. They became the Enron of their day.
Oh, really?
So they had to pay off the bank. I mean, the bank was calling Baldwin. You know, they were calling in the loan.
Yeah.
They weren't calling just to say hi. You know, they were,
give me my money.
Exactly. So basically, they had to sell everything off in order to pay off their debt. And Duke Kramer, who had been with Gretsch since 1935, I mean, he had retired a few years earlier by this time. He caught wind about this and contacted Fred W., and he set up a meeting. Fred officially bought the company back, I believe, in November of 84, and then announced it to the world on January 1st of 85 that the company was now family-owned again.
Now, do you know what he... Do we know what he paid for the company?
I didn't ask, and I wasn't told.
Well, it's good it's back in family hands, and I'm sure it's whatever it was, it's worth getting it back. So, all right, so then we're kind of getting in the modern times here, and I think we should kind of bring it on home. And I know there's KMC Music. They become the distributor worldwide.
Yeah, they become the distributor for Gretsch Drums in 2000. It's basically a licensing deal. You know, where they're they don't own the name, but, you know, they take care of the day-to-day, the distribution,
stores,
service, and all that stuff. Yeah, it's,
gotcha.
It's sort of like a Salesforce for hire, you know, kind of like a broker.
Yeah.
Command at that time was really, you know, huge. And they were very good at percussion, you know, because they owned LP, Gibraltar Hardware, and so forth. And so they, you know, CB and all that stuff. So, you know, they had it together. And also they had great connections overseas, you know, with manufacturers, you know, to introduce more affordable import lines of Gretsch drums and so forth. And, you know, that's when that happened. And actually a couple of years later, Fred did the same thing with Fender. Same thing, a licensing deal for the guitars, you know. So, and the funny thing is that so in 2000, Fred does a distribution deal with Command for the drums, and then 2002, 2003, he does the same thing with Fender for the guitars. And then in 2007, the end of 2007, Fender buys Command for $117 million in cash.
My God, wow.
So the funny thing is that this, nobody could have foreseen this, but by the end of 2007, Gretsch drums and Gretsch guitars are under the Fender umbrella.
My gosh.
Because now they own Command, which distributes Gretsch drums.
Yeah.
So it's just an interesting thing.
So from that 2000, 2007, these acquisitions, there's different lines coming out, but I think, which is a whole thing, but I think keeping it on track here, 2015, DW, they come into the picture.
Okay, yeah. Actually, it was December 23rd, 2014 that the deal is done. But I can tell you what led up to that.
Yeah, please do.
Okay, in 2014, a company called Texas Pacific Group buys Fender. And the first thing that Texas Pacific Group decides is let's dump KMC.
Interesting.
So they try to sell KMC for $50 million. Now, keep in mind that Fender bought KMC for $117 million.
Yeah, that's quite a loss.
But that wasn't Texas Pacific Group's money. That was Fender's money.
Yeah.
So they don't care.
Yeah.
So let's just unload it for $50 million, get rid of it, and move on. But there's no takers. No, not even for $50 million does anybody want to buy KMC. So from what I heard, what happens at this point when they just can't sell it, DW raises their hand and they say, well, we're interested in the drum brands.
Yeah.
So, and that includes exclusive distribution of Gretsch drums, ownership of Gibraltar, Latin Percussion, Percussion Plus or Pro Percussion, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And Cat Electronic Drums and CB Drums and, you know, a few other lesser brands that KMC owned. And again, I don't know. I wasn't told. I didn't ask.
Yeah.
So I don't know what DW got it for.
Yeah.
And then what was left of KMC went to a company in Canada, another musical distributor in Canada called Jam Industries. Hmm. But KMC still exists today, and they still function as they always have. They've taken on a lot of other new brands to kind of recover from the losses.
Yeah.
They're very nice people at KMC. I know those people very well, and they're terrific people.
Well, and then my only question moving with the DW thing would be, what is the role of Fred W. Gretsch, and compared to, is he still owns the name Gretsch?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
okay.
And that's the way it's always been, no matter whether it was KMC or Fender, you know, or Hal Leonard, you know.
Yeah.
Because Hal Leonard, as of mid-2017, they took on Gretsch Import Drums, which is renowned Catalina Club, Catalina Maple, and Energy. They took on, you know, all the Gretsch import lines, as well as Gibraltar Hardware and Cat Electronic Drums, and you know, all the former brands that KMC had.
Well, and the Catalina line itself is just inexpensive drums, but they are amazing. I mean, I owned a practice little extra kit of a Catalina mod kit I got when I was teaching at Sam Ash, and I got a good deal on it. It was awesome. It had a really cool, unique bass drum size, and for the price, I paid like $300. They are great, inexpensive drums. Obviously, they have all price ranges of drums, but I love the thing.
Oh yeah, sure. Well, it's they have a price point for, you know, for every budget. I'll let you in on something. This book that Rob Cook and I did, you know, the Gretsch drum book, which came out in 2013, which pretty much has all the information you'd ever want to know about Gretsch, at least up to 2013 when it came out.
Yeah.
You know what the hardest part for me of doing that book was?
What?
The time that KMC owned it.
Really?
Because so many things came and went so quickly, including drum lines and sizes and colors, and, you know, it's like there were more changes in the 14 years that KMC distributed Gretsch than all the changes that Gretsch went through in the 20th century.
That's hysterical. Wow.
You know,
from 2000 to 2014. That's amazing.
It was so difficult to keep up with, because, like, I'm a Gretsch expert. If I'm knowledgeable about Gretsch drums and I'm getting confused, then
there's an
what,
issue.
What does the average guy on the street that wants to buy a drum set, going to be? I mean, he's going to be.
Yeah.
Well, what's
really
the difference between Marquee and Catalina Maple and, you know, and New Classic and, you know, and these are like dead lines, by the way.
Exactly.
You know, like, I mean,
oh, yeah. Yeah,
you
know, yeah, yeah.
I mean, Marquee only lasted a year.
That's
and
so
that
funny.
Was KMC's last year. So.
Wow.
Yeah. Just really, I mean, oh, my goodness. It was like, I mean, in fact, I when we had lunch with Fred in November, I told him that story, you know.
Yeah,
and I said that's one of the things that I'm so glad about what DW did is like you know they just got rid of
strip it away,
they shaved away.
Yeah,
all, they just kept the four lines, the four import lines that sold, and then of course you know then there's USA quality. I mean you know there's the you got the Brooklyn series that came out in 2012, you got the Broadcaster series that came out in at the end of 2014 into 2015, and they're tremendous, you know. In fact, I've got a Broadcaster kit on order for myself right now, so
nice.
I'm looking to get that because that'll be my first brand new three ply kit.
Wow.
So I'm so looking forward to that kit.
The love continues, and I think that's a perfect
Absolutely.
Segue to say So 2019, we are in the 136th year of Gretsch, which is unbelievable.
Yep.
You said it multiple times, and I should have said it at the top, but I want people to know that, John, you co-wrote the Gretsch book with our friend Rob Cook.
Rob Cook, yep.
Folks can go out and find that. Pretty much, I'd say just Google it, and you will find it. It is a great resource for everything Gretsch. I think what we got here today is a very wonderful, in-depth look at everything to do with Gretsch, which I am fascinated with, and I feel now that I know 1,000% more than I did before. So I thank you so much.
Okay, I'm glad that that you got something out of it.
And, this was great.
Go Gretsch, you know, that great Gretsch sound, that great Gretsch gravitas, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely the thing, you know. If any of your listeners are in the Northeast, you know, I do all the drum shows in the Northeast. The Delaware Drum Show is coming up. It's February 24th, and then there's the Connecticut Drum Show in in Newington on April 14th, and then there's the Pennsylvania Drum Show in Selwyn's Grove, and that is October 19th.
That's
so
awesome.
And I do all these shows, and I also have copies of the book there.
Cool.
The hardcover version.
Nice.
Which you can't get online, so keep that in mind.
Cool. Well, I recommend people go up to you. You're a nice guy, and I don't think
you'll
bite if they come up and talk to you and say, hey, I heard you on Drum History. John,
okay.
I really appreciate it, man. I'll let you go and enjoy the rest of your day, and I hope to see you at one of the drum shows down the road.
Okay, sure. Yeah, no problem. And, it's real pleasure talking to you. It's great what you do, and I'm looking forward to listening to your other podcasts.
Thank you so much. This has been awesome.
Very welcome.
John, you have yourself a good day. Thank you, my friend.
You too, man. Sure.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning. This is a Gwyn Sound podcast.